This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to episode 107 of Awards Chatter, the Hollywood Reporter's awards podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and my guest today is one of the fastest rising young actors out there, Adam Driver. The 33-year-old first came to prominence in 2012, playing the complex and controversial character Adam Sackler on Lena Dunham's dark comedy series Girls, the sixth and final season of which was recently completed and will air in the spring on HBO. Starting a year before that, though, and during breaks from the show, Driver has played parts of varying size in films for many of the best directors in the world. From Clint Eastwood's J. Edgar, to Steven Spielberg's Lincoln, to the Coen Brothers' Inside Llewyn Davis, to Noah Baumbach's Francis Ha and While We're Young, to Martin Scorsese's forthcoming Silence. He's now best known for playing Kylo Ren, the grandson of Darth Vader, in J.J. Abrams' 2015 blockbuster Star Wars: The Force Awakens, a role he'll reprise in future installments of the franchise. But he recently earned the best reviews of his career for his performance in a movie a fraction of their size, Jim Jarmusch's Patterson, which premiered at Sundance back in January. In that quiet and understated film, which chronicles a seven-day period, he plays a small-town bus driver who also writes beautiful poetry. Over the course of our conversation, Driver and I discuss a wide range of topics, among them his pre-stardom service in the U.S. Marines, his subsequent training at Juilliard, the casting sessions that landed him his part on Girls and in Star Wars, his attraction to a character who listens far more than he talks in Patterson, and his own plans for the future. So without further ado, let's go to that conversation.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of the Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play the Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Adam, thanks so much for doing this. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We always begin with just a stock question. Where were you born and raised, and what did or do your folks do for a living?
I was born in Fontana, California, and immediately moved to San Diego, lived there till I was seven, but was raised in a small town in Indiana called Mishawaka, which is in the kind of the southern border of Michigan, northern border of Indiana, next to South Bend and Notre Dame. My mom is a paralegal for a private practice of family law, this guy named Fred Haynes, and my father works at an Office Max in Arkansas.
So I have tried to read up on you a little bit before this, obviously, and one thing I was surprised to learn was that, and maybe it's not true, but I'm gonna ask you, was the first time that you acted really not, you'd not acted prior to high school at all?
I did like little things in like church plays when I was four, you know, okay. and five, yeah. you know, but not really. I didn't act really until I auditioned for a play in elementary school, yeah. and like they cast me as the curtain boy, so I just opened the curtains for my fellow classmates, but they knew to kind of keep me behind the.
Right.
A curtain as much as possible so no one would see me.
And then what happened in high school? It just started out with a very small thing, right?
Yeah, it was Oklahoma at the very end of the year. They have like the big musical that everyone like, you know, tries out for. And again, I was entrusted with a very small role. My line was check his heart. It's right after Curly gets shot. I say check his heart. And then the drama teacher left and then a new drama teacher came. And I auditioned for Arsenic and Old Lace the next year, my sophomore year. And I got cast as Mortimer Brewster, which was a big deal. So I was very excited about
that. And you were starting to now develop more of a passion for doing this?
Yeah, yeah. I remember like trying to take it seriously. Or like to feel, I feel like I was kind of good at it. And I'm like, oh, I'll just stick with things that I'm good at because I wasn't really good at anything else.
Really?
Yeah.
Not a sports guy, not a...
No, I tried sports. I was never really good at it. Yeah. I like made the B team, you know, and if they were really desperate, they'd put me on the A team. But the B team, because I knew it didn't count, you know, I was really good in the B. Like, I was very bold and like passed a lot and shot a lot. But in the A team, because I knew it counted, I got in my head and
right.
get really nervous and run out of bounds.
So now you're coming out of high school, having done several high school productions of various shows, and your outlook at that point, I believe that I read you auditioned for Juilliard.
Uh-huh.
But if you can connect the dots from that point until about a year later, when instead of being at Juilliard, you were now, I believe, in the U.S. military, what went on during that period that led from one place into such a very different place?
Yeah. So I was interested in acting, but I didn't get good grades. So my parents, you know, grounded me from theater a lot. I couldn't do it. And school, I just hated. I didn't like it. Didn't have the focus. I'd skip class a lot. And I knew I was still interested in acting, and I knew Juilliard, the emphasis really wasn't on grades. It was about your ability. So I'm like, okay, I'll try there. So that, because I didn't get good grades. And that was the only school that I auditioned for. Really? It was Juilliard. I just knew it was really good. So I'm like, oh, sure, I'll just go there.
Yeah.
And I didn't get in. And I was like, okay, that's it. I'm not going to apply for college. And then later I was like, maybe I'll go to a community college locally. And I was working as like a groundskeeper at 4-H Fairgrounds, you know, like painting and mowing the big lawn that they had. I was a telemarketer for like three different telemarketing companies. One was like Ben Franklin Construction, where we try to like, you know, sell this guy's construction company. Remember, he was like a big fan. This is a random detail. The guy that ran the company wasn't named Ben Franklin, but he really loved the movie. Oh, God. What's that? That David Mamet play that they... Glengarry Glen Ross.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
and he
yeah.
would talk about, you know...
Always be closing.
Yeah, yeah. To us all the time, like it was the Bible. And then at a basement waterproofing company was the other one I telemarketed for, where you called people and tried to convince them that their basement was leaking. And then September 11th happened, and I felt like I wasn't doing anything. And, you know, graduate from high school, had no future really planned. And, you know, also that combined with filled the sense of patriotism and of the age to feel like I wanted to do something. So then I, you know, I signed up for the Marine Corps and was gone by the next January or February.
Wow. And in that intervening period, though, is it correct that you had actually come out to Los Angeles just to explore that possibility?
Oh, that's right. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. This November, I think the month before... month before September 11th, because obviously I can't remember the time. Maybe it was right after September 11th, right before, actually, the timeline is wrong.
Yeah.
I moved out to LA
yeah.
to begin my acting career. Like I would try to, and I didn't have a lot of money, and I had a big like 1990 Lincoln Town Car. So I filled everything up, and my parents, I was living in the back paying. I'm rambling now.
No, it's good.
They wouldn't let me go to the front of the house when I graduated. I had to go to the back of the house, and I lived in the back room, and I had to pay rent, you know, so they tried to make it.
Urge you to get out of there.
Right, like it was my apartment.
Right.
So I packed all my shit and put it in the back of this Lincoln Town Car. So it's just barely hovering above the earth, you know, it's filled with this mini fridge and every all my possessions. And I drove. And I made it to Amarillo, Texas, or just outside, and it broke down. And I spent all my money fixing this shitty car.
Shitty car.
So by the time I got to Santa Monica, not even LA, I'd had no money. And there was some loose family connection of like a professor at UCLA. I can't remember.
Right.
And I met him, but I was basically here for 48 hours, and I had no money, and I wasn't going to call home for money.
Right.
So I just turned around and drove back, and that was the end of my.
And when you got back was when the idea was put forward that maybe a military option would be a better path?
Yeah, I had got a brochure in the mail, and my stepdad was, we were having an argument about what was I doing with my life and my future. And he's like, why don't you join the Marine Corps? I'm like, fuck no, I'm not going to join the Marine Corps. Then he left, and I'm like, well, maybe I will. You know, like, I'll think about it. But then, so I left.
So you're 18 when you started there and started in the Marine Corps, and how formative was that period in your life? Did you adjust well to the sort of, sounds like a lot more discipline than you'd maybe had in your life up to that point? Did you like it?
Yeah, I did, which is kind of strange now because I hate authority or hate people telling me what to do. And that's what the Marine Corps is filled with that. I do remember liking it right away. I mean, I never had, because I wasn't in sports, I didn't have that guy test where you were a bunch of dudes, you know, and that I didn't never had that camaraderie. So that was kind of interesting to me to. And I guess why I joined initially, this kind of went away. And then I started forming these friendships with these people. And then it kind of turned into being about that, you know. And I was also, there's something that maybe because you're aware of your mortality, maybe younger at age than a typical maybe 18 or 19 year old isn't. You're just aware of like time management and what you can do in a day. And that was a big, I grew up a lot in that time.
I read about one particular incident where something kind of went wrong with when you were out with a group, and that sort of clarified that after this you're going back to acting. Is that correct?
Yeah, we were doing training in, I think, Pendleton or 29 Palms. I can't remember. And our artillery was firing white phosphorus over our heads, and we were mortarmen. So artillery is like a mile away from us. And someone, the forward observer, the FO, gave them the wrong coordinates, and they fired on us. So we're shooting, and then we look up, and there's a big explosion of white phosphorus. And so we all started running.
Which is pretty deadly stuff, right?
Yeah, it'll burn, you know, it's supposed to, acid will burn right through you. And then I'm like, oh, there's the things I want to do in my life before I die. And the two that came to my head first were smoking. I didn't smoke, you know, but that seemed like a good idea. And it, you know, when I become a civilian again, I wanted to be an actor.
Right.
Yeah.
And that opportunity to get into acting again came about because of a sort of pretty awful injury that you suffered while you were there?
Yeah. I was in a mountain biking accident, and handlebars went to my chest and broke my sternum. So then they were like, you're not going to deploy. And that was a big blow. And then I tried to keep training on it, you know, and loading up on hydrocodone so I could go overseas. And it never was really healing. And so, like, you know, I'd be medically separated.
And I heard that, you know, for you, it was kind of a depressing thing because this was your group of guys, right? That was how you felt about being separated from or not being able to join them.
Yeah. I was similar. You know, you join for, like I was saying, all these political reasons, maybe, and that coupled with, you know, not doing anything.
Right.
You can really are proud of to begin with. But then it turns into being there with the guys that you've been with for the past 2 years, you know, where it's kind of rare where in the civilian world, you're put in like these very heightened life and death, sometimes circumstances with a group of people, and then they kind of rise to the occasion. You don't really have a lot of those relationships in the civilian world. I mean, maybe that's generalizing, but for me, I didn't at that time. So you are very close with people in a way that you don't have in the civilian world, and not being there with them to do that job and someone else taking my place to do that job and having that experience with those guys was a big blow.
Oh, yeah. So now you come out, though, you've got, I guess, with the GI Bill, you're able to do University of Indianapolis for a year, and then...
You know everything.
Julia, I'm trying.
No, yeah.
But then it's another shot at Juilliard, right?
Right, yeah. I got out in like June or something, and the audition process for Juilliard was already over. So I went to University of Indianapolis for a year and did plays.
Yeah.
And waited to audition for Juilliard again, and that time got in.
Could you tell that it went better this time? What did you do differently?
I think I just had more life experience that I brought to the monologues. I still wasn't as prepared. I didn't know much really about theater or you know, Shakespeare. And even at that time, I did the opening monologue from Richard III, but I didn't really know Richard III, and I don't think I'd finished the play. But I think my life experience just at 17 or 18 when I first auditioned, you're so eager to please and just be liked that I really had no point of view about anything that I was saying. And the second time I did. And I think maybe that came through in my audition, maybe.
We just had Jessica Chastain in here last week to do an episode, and she was also she's also a Juilliard alum, and she said that her time there and in New York was so influential in everything that's followed that it was just very formative. She, especially as someone not coming from a big city and then experiencing all of that, and I just wonder if you had a similar experience there, or if it, you know, what you feel you took away from your time getting the BFA.
Yeah, similar to that, and I did not come from a big city, very small town, and it was not, you know, it's not full of culture, and suddenly you're in Lincoln Center, which, you know, the opera, the city ballet, it's all right there, so that was a huge education. I didn't know, but, you know, I didn't have an encyclopedic knowledge of playwrights or, you know, the plays that I'm supposed to know, and so I was very new to all of it, and also the Marine Corps is great acting training because you're, you know, with a group of guys that are your age, they're kind of living under very heightened circumstances, and that makes kind of people behave in strange ways when they're trying to cope and don't have the words for it or can't figure out how to process it. So at Juilliard, I learned, I think, a way to learn, which was which I had no kind of set process before, where you're also like, you know, spending a lot of time working on yourself for 4 years, which at the time was actually kind of agonizing. Yeah. I did not have a good time for most of it. It's only in retrospect that I'm like, oh, that was really valuable.
You're right.
Where you're focusing on your voice and your movement and, you know, where your feet are and all that shit. But what it does do is if you want to have a long career where you have to maintain things, that it gives you all the actor cliche thing of the tools in your toolbox and that. So it was good not knowing anything. And also because I had a little bit more life experience, I wasn't like swallowing everything they told me completely. I would kind of challenge it a bit, which was fun.
I heard that the sort of breakout moment in a way for you there, maybe, you know, I just wonder if you agree, was that during your fourth year, you did the show Burn This, which led to an agent, which led to the things that maybe came after. Was that a big turning point in your own view?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Your last year, they do a play that they try to cater to your strengths, or you kind of start there at Juilliard in your first year, and they try to get you away from your habits as much as possible. And hopefully by the end of your fourth year, you kind of go back to maybe your strengths that you had to begin with, but being able to access new faculties or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that was. And then my agent, or my future agent, came and saw that, and then it started working from there. She's behind me right now.
That's where it started.
And I've been trying to get rid of her, but she keeps on like following me to all these things. It's kind of a nightmare.
Well, so now you're coming out into the real world, and first jobs that you got, it looks like, were on TV. When you were coming out, what sort of a career did you envision for yourself? Was screen acting always going to be a part of it? Or
no, I mean, that would have been great. I think my only game plan was to make a living as an actor, like I, you know, come from a theater school. So if I would have done theater for forever, that would have been great. What an ideal career, you know, that great, you know, if anything else on top of that, even just that, making a living as an actor is a miracle in and of itself. So then when all these like TV and film jobs came, you know, it's still very like, what a lucky opportunity they are.
Just so people know who were not necessarily in New York and able to appreciate this, you were doing still a lot of stage work in those immediate years afterwards, including first, I think Angels in America must have been a huge thing to do off-Broadway.
Yeah, the
revival.
Best play I've ever worked on.
And you felt you evolved as an actor doing it?
Yeah, I just that play is so well constructed. I think it's my favorite play of all time.
Yeah.
Tony Kushner's writing is like an amazing, who also wrote Lincoln and Munich and a bunch of other things. He has a great way of articulating these complex ideas, but at the same time not sacrificing the kind of humanity that are happening in scenes. And one of them is a scene with Lewis in Belize when he's trying to kind of go in this long monologue kind of about racism and democracy, and it really is all about how he feels so guilty for leaving Pryor. And it's those plays when we did both parts, Millennium Approaches, yes, and Perestroika. So it's, and we did them in rep. So on Saturday, we do both plays. So it's 6 hours, Jesus, of acting. I think we did them on Saturday and Sunday, mm-hmm, or Friday and Saturday. And, you know, throughout the week, we do alternate. And that was just a really great lesson. Even, yeah, those plays are 6 hours, because they're so well constructed and well written, that at the end, you still felt like you had, and you weren't like draining, really, the tank, because all you had to do is rely on the words. And the writing kind of got you to where you needed to go. You didn't have to put anything on top of that. And, yeah, that was a huge lesson to learn.
And then it must just be, for any actor, a huge deal to make it to Broadway, which in back-to-back years, you're doing Mrs. Warren's Professional Cherry Jones in 2010, then Man and a Boy, Frank Langella, 2011. For you, it must have seemed like things were really going as well as they could have at that point, right?
I mean, yeah, no, it was great. I was having a great time. Frank Langella, I learned a lot from him, yeah, almost maybe more than any other actor that I'd worked with on, really, stage, because he's so ferocious and commands a presence. And ferocious is the best word, mm-hmm, to kind of describe him.
I just saw The Father this past year. It's amazing.
Yeah, he's incredible.
So how did you first hear about Girls? And was this just sort of another audition, or did you realize when you were going in that this was going to be a potentially a big thing?
I did not know what it was going to be. I had done a show called The Wonderful Maladies for HBO, and I liked them. I thought they were different than regular TV. I thought TV is kind of the devil at the time. And I initially read it and did not want to go in. But then the agent who we were talking about earlier, who really, it really is a problem, that said, no, you should go in on it.
Now, why did you not want to go in?
Because it was just TV, and like I was like doing a play at the time. Right. I think it was Mrs. Warren's Profession. And yeah. I'm like, this is where I need to be. Right. You know, fuck television. I don't want to get this, you know, cesspool of, right, vipers. I don't want to. And I just didn't. I think it was just like, I had also had a string of other things that,
yeah,
I auditioned for that I just hated. And
you do go in, though, at the urging of your agent, and I believe you showed up, according to Lena, with a motorcycle helmet and just had a read on this character. I think you were the first person that she said she saw, but you felt there was an immediate connection with the character and with her, or did you not?
I did, actually. Yeah. I typically, I feel, try to be overprepared in auditions, where I hated the power dynamic, you know, that happened in auditions, where you go in and you like seem desperate to want something. So I always try to take control over and be like, this is my opportunity to, right, act. So fuck them. You know, hated them immediately. It's a tactic, you know,
and especially for survival. You're looking at such a young person you're auditioning for. It must, yeah, have been a little weird.
Yeah, yeah. So I came in and I typically I would have been more prepared, but because I was in this like state of self-entitlement, like I didn't prepare it as much. I'm like, I'm just going to go in and read, yeah, you know. And the motorcycle helmet wasn't a prop. I like just rode my bike there and I don't know, maybe showing I didn't care,
right, you
know. And then it was really, I met Lena and we started playing the scenes that I got really excited by it. And I think because I didn't prepare, I made choices that were, on the page, Adam Sackler seems very aggressive, but we were kind of playing against it and having fun with it. Having fun, it's a terrible, terrible word for fun is awful.
But, you know, like it, yeah.
But because we started playing around, it was, I think I didn't get in my head too much, and I got really excited about, yeah, it then.
So you get it, you start playing this, there's this, the show really took off, and I know that the reactions to this guy were strong. People, mm-hmm,
initially, yeah.
Initially, right? And I just wonder, you know, he's sort of a primal guy, I guess. It's sort of, I wondered if you personally liked him, and if you, what you made of these, the fact that you were evoking such strong reactions from people. Probably couldn't go down the street without getting some smart-ass comments.
No, yeah, for the first couple episodes, I've never had the experience where you do something on we also shot it like a year before it actually came out. Okay. So I kind of not forgot about it. Right. I knew it was happening, but couldn't really remember what we did. And then after the first 2 weeks going outside and, and people being like, hey, fuck you. for no reason. Yeah. But then that character evolved. But I liked it. Yeah. I liked him immediately when Lena and I sat down to talk about it before we started shooting it, that like what kind of person he was, mm-hmm, and that he was very much a rhinoceros who can only really see what's going on in front of him and runs full force towards that until he gets exhausted and then finds something else. And has these kind of weird off-center philosophies on life that he really knows nothing about, but is fully committed to them. That was always kind of funny to me.
Interesting. So how did the experience of doing that show, which in the interim, I know that's when you started, I guess, on breaks doing much higher profile movies as well, which we can touch upon, but how do you think that that changed you, if it did, as an actor? Were you different coming out of, now that we're, the show's just recently wrapped, are you a different actor today than you were when you were starting that?
I don't know. That's a hard thing to say. Yes, I feel like I've had experiences where I feel like I'm trying to be more economical with the way you work on something, and also kind of learning to adapt to the vibe of the set, I think, is what I didn't know then that I kind of know now, not trying to impose your way of working. Not that I did then, but I didn't really have a set way of, I didn't know where the rhythm of a film set. So was kind of working in a bubble until we would do the scenes, and then I'd be available for my scene partners. Yeah. But I found in my experiences, not really trying to have less control and structuring it around, like being aware of what the pace is around me, as opposed to having a set way of working and trying to impose it on everyone else.
Right.
It seemed like something I took away from it. But being on a show for 6 years, in a way, it feels like a movie, and it also feels like theater, you know, where you, I always feel at the end of a run of a play, always I want to go back to the very beginning and do it again. Like, now I have a better sense of what it is. But because of Girls, I got to do that with a character where at the end of every season, I'm like, okay, now I have a good jumping off point for Adam. I'm just now starting to get it. And if I could do it again, this is what I would do different. Then you can.
Yeah. And so during those breaks from the show, when it was on hiatus or whatever, you had some amazing opportunities come about, and I just wonder, it seems like, just to list them off, the first one, I guess, was J. Edgar for Clint Eastwood, then Lincoln for Spielberg and Kushner, then Inside Llewyn Davis for the Coen brothers, then twice, I think, for Noah Baumbach, where you got to show a little bit of a funnier side of yourself with Francis Ha, and then While We're Young. Was the criteria here, I just want to take these opportunities that I have to be away from Girls to work with the best directors I can work with, or it happens that it worked out that each one of these is with sort of a real terrific auteur?
Well, I think it's a mixture of both. I wanted to, it's a director's medium, and I think of it very much as a service industry acting, and I wanted to work with really great directors who, movies I admire growing up, you know, in Indiana, like binge watching things from Blockbuster Video.
Yeah.
It's like a cultural outlet, I guess. But I could want that all I want, or, you know, but I was lucky enough to actually get the opportunities to work with these people. So it seemed like a no-brainer job choices. If someone asked you, do you want to do, you know, audition for a Clint Eastwood movie? Yeah. Or do you want to work with Jim Jarmusch? Like,
right.
Of course. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And Clint, though, was the first one in terms of a movie who cast you in a movie?
Yeah. Yeah.
And do you know why that came about?
I just auditioned for it and he saw the tape, and that was kind of it.
Was it?
Yeah.
It's not a pretty nice way to start your film big screen career.
Also, I worked with Barry Levinson too, which I was really, that was also another HBO thing that was a surreal moment, because my scene partners were Al Pacino, Susan Sarandon, and John Goodman.
This was You Don't Know Jack?
Don't Know Jack. And I played a guy who tried to burn himself, and they wanted to cover one of my eyes. I'm like, no, could you just leave just a crack? I want to see what is going to happen. Which probably would have been better, so they wouldn't have, if I covered an eye, so the panic wouldn't have been as obvious.
So I believe it was while you were back on the set of Girls that you first heard from J.J. Abrams. Is that the case?
Yeah. The third or fourth season, the last day of shooting the third or fourth season, I got a call, you know, do you want to meet with J.J. to talk about Star Wars? And just, sure.
It was specifically about Star Wars, or was it? You kind of knew what he was after?
I knew it was Star Wars. I didn't know what the character was or anything at that point. Just, did you want to fly out to LA and meet JJ? And I'm like, yeah, that seemed interesting.
And when you found out what it was all about and who he was interested in having you play and all of that, did you have any hesitation about saying yes? Because one thing that some of the other people who have done various incarnations of Star Wars have said is that it sort of, in some ways, not always positively defined them. Going forward, they found that it was harder for people to see them as other things. And I wondered, you know, obviously that doesn't apply to all. Many of them have gone on and had terrific, varied careers. But was there any concern, as somebody who had not done large-scale things, movies necessarily before, I guess, you know, or at least not as a central character, anything that gave you pause about saying yes?
Yeah, I had a lot of apprehension and doing it. Not for what you're talking about of like thinking ahead, because I don't think I was there yet as far as what its effect would be or what the end result would be afterwards. I was more thinking about how, you know, finding your way in and making it make sense to yourself. And, you know, what is the source material for it? I mean, obviously the original movies, but you have to kind of make, it has to make sense for you. Yeah. And they were kind of outlining it, but there was no script to read until the first, so you've already kind of agreed to do it and, really, yeah. and you're there on set. Then you kind of read what you've committed to, but JJ outlined it and it got me really excited. I'm very wary of Hollywood movies. Because I feel like a lot of them they sacrifice story for spectacle, and it's very much about effects and results as opposed to characters that you can actually connect with. But the first words out of JJ's mouth were about story and character, and that would propel the plot forward, not, you know, an effect. And
right.
That was really exciting to me initially. But then I wanted to think about it for a couple months, and then it was like 6 more months after that of scheduling to see if it could work, because right. I was still shooting Girls. But yeah, I just didn't want to fuck it up, really. Like, you know, what a, you know, awesome opportunity. But, you know, what if you get there and have no ideas on the day? And I remember having conversations with JJ being like, you know, I feel kind of overwhelmed by the idea of it. And he said something that was very smart, that it was so obvious, which was, you know, we'll break it up into little pieces and solve those little pieces and then worry about this moment, which will lead to that moment. And the end result, you know, hopefully we'll have a movie. But
yeah.
And so that made sense to me.
And it ended up feeling not like a different sort of acting than you'd done in other things. You felt good doing it.
Well, yeah, because you have to like solve all the problems for yourself. You can't just, because the vocabulary in Star Wars is so ingrained into your culture, but you still have to make it make sense. So why do they wear helmets? Yeah, you know, why is the motion that he's reaching out to use the Force? Is there some kind of... I went back to the Kurosawa's movies, actually, which kind of initially inspired George Lucas. Mm-hmm. The Hidden Fortress in particular was a movie that made a lot of sense. You know, when I made it kind of political in my mind, then I'm like, then it made sense to me.
Yeah.
You know, we have these two parties who are on opposite sides who believe that they're 100% correct,
yeah.
You know, and there's a family dynamic in the midst of it. And that makes it more complicated, but the idea of two people thinking that they're 100% right, you know, made it less easier to get in as opposed to like the obvious dark side and light side. I didn't think about that at all.
And I wonder if, as a guy who's been in the military at a time when we're engaged in the war on terrorism, which is essentially, again, like you're saying, like kind of people that are totally true believers of their position on either side, it seems like it's not entirely unrelated to the real world in some ways, but...
Yeah, or even our current political climate.
Yeah.
Whenever a group of people, I think, tell another group or show another group that they are 100% correct, I'm always suspicious.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So movie comes out, obviously a huge phenomenon. How has it impacted your ability to just go about your business? And also, is it a little surreal when a few weeks ago it's Halloween, I think one of the most popular costumes kids are going trick-or-treating in was you as Kylo. Right. I mean, is it just... What do you make of it all?
I don't know. I don't know how to process all of it. It's really fun. Like the kid element, the kids element is really fun. I was dropping my wife off in front of our house and parking the car around, and I was driving around our block, and I turned the corner, and there was a mom like picking up her kids from school, and she had 3 kids, and they're all running in different directions with like backpacks all over, and she was holding my lightsaber, but she was holding it in a way like she holds lightsabers all the time, you know, like it was such a burden, like, oh god, this fucking lightsaber, you know. And she was slinging it over her shoulders with all like diaper bags and backpacks, and that image of her, like, you know, completely, you know, jeans and a t-shirt with the lightsaber going down, like, oh, this fucking thing. I'm like, I know. It's
you get it.
Yeah. It's an awkward thing to hold, you know. It's a weird thing to watch you walking down my neighborhood
with one.
And I'll see you at the house later. Am I scare the shit out of your kids?
Right.
look, Cole again for Halloween.
So, from that massive scale kind of a project, you then, I think chronologically, then go and do Patterson.
Yes. Yeah, I think
which
that's right.
I know we talked about this the other day, but just for context, even if it's not an exact figure, like, what's roughly the budget and the shooting schedule for Star Wars versus Patterson?
Because I don't know, I need to know how movies are made or how much money goes into making movies. But I asked this afterwards. I gave you that terrible answer. And they think it was around $5 million.
$5 million.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. Again, I don't know what the budget of Star Wars is. I'm not thinking about the budget, but it was more than that.
Yes. A few multiples.
Yeah.
So now you're doing, you get offered Patterson, and the reason that you immediately were drawn to it was because as this guy who was sort of a cinephile growing up, you were familiar with and a fan of Jarmusch?
Yeah, totally, 100%. His movies are, I think, are brilliant, and he's brilliant. I didn't know him at the time, yeah. But solely because he was involved in it, I wanted to be in it.
And as you're reading the script and looking at this character who doesn't say much, right? He's, as you noted, largely a listener, which is not something many movies are built around. And then also a story, which is sort of the opposite of every cliche. We see a gun, but it's not going to kill somebody. We see, you know, whatever. I think that, what was that Godard? It's like, if you show a gun, somebody's going to get shot.
Yeah, right.
So it's like throwing all this on its head. That's what you were drawn to, but also is that something where you're like, how do I communicate as a guy who has very little verbally to say?
I don't know. I'm always, I love scenes where I don't have a lot to say, where I get to listen to people. I've been really lucky to work with really great people, though. So that's made it easier. And I knew Jim just attracts people that are great and that he's interested in are inherently interesting. Yeah. And so I knew that I didn't really think of that. I was more excited that playing a character where you have to trust that the power of thought is interesting enough, that that's cinematic enough that people would be interested in watching someone process something or take in details. And that was a kind of, you know, you just have to, I don't think you get that opportunity a lot to play with that idea. Yeah. And it seemed unique.
Now, aside from what was on the page, what, if anything, were you able to do to prepare to play this guy?
Well, I tried to, you know, up my game as far as knowing the poetry world. Mm-hmm. I had a very elementary knowledge of poetry, like E.E. Cummings, and mm-hmm. I knew, you know, Allen Ginsberg's Howl, but I didn't know anything apart from that. Or I didn't know Frank O'Hara's Lunch yeah. Poems or anything by William Carlos Williams apart from This Is Just to Say.
Yeah.
So studying that and learning about poetry through Jim in particular, who was studying under Kenneth Koch at Columbia, was really exciting, and reading Ron Padgett's poems. And then just the physical life seemed to be very key because he has a very well-worn groove as far as his routine every day. He takes the same path to work, you know, takes the same bus route. The clothes that he wears, apart from his uniform, are pretty similar. Yeah. So he pretty much wears the same thing every day. And I knew that being there on the day, I didn't want to be thinking about it. We're trying to tell a story of someone who's been doing this routine for years, and we only had to shoot it in a couple months. So learning how to drive a bus and getting my CDL license, I thought would be important to maybe open us up to, we can get better shots.
Yeah.
Even, I think we were able to do two shots, you know, that where I could drive the bus. But to me, that was worth it.
It was still valuable.
And also on the day, I didn't want to be thinking like what lever does what right. Where does the key go? You know, like how wide is my bus?
Right.
What's the air pressure? Right. In the tires, like I wanted to be available, yeah. You know, for yeah. my scene partners and the crew. Right. Like you want to not be thinking about it.
Sure. Now, one thing I wondered watching this movie is there a reason that Jim wanted to tell this story? Is there something about what happens to, spoiler alert, Patterson's work at the end? Is there something that we should all take away from that? Is that a metaphor?
You mean, is there something specifically that he wanted people to take away from that moment?
Well, I would say overall, but also the thing that really I wondered is when we see that somebody's, what they've poured their heart and soul into, the material evidence of that is now gone, but he figures out, you know, I think that last scene is so beautiful. Right. I guess I just wonder, is there more to that than meets the eye in your view?
I think so. I don't know that he had a set point in all of it. I'm sure it was multi-purpose of, yeah, a lot of what we were talking about, subverting people's expectations. He's really interested in the fact that he was in the military, or the fact that he was a bus driver, or the fact that he's a poet, but he's not defined by any one of those things is also, I think, a point that he was trying to make. That scene in particular, I think maybe he was trying to say, or what I get out of it is that I think there's a line in one of the poems where he says, you know, words are written on water. And then I love that idea. And there's the, you know, the Passaic Falls and mm-hmm. and Patterson. So that things happen, you know, or we create things, even making a movie, everyone's decided to leave their families, you know, for this certain amount of time. Someone's giving us a lot of money, yeah. all for us to be here at this time and tell this one story, you know, this scene, this time, and then we're going to break for lunch. It's all, you know. So I think maybe the idea is that we can't hold on to anything, and that's kind of Patterson's philosophy, that yeah. things happen, and then he has a mourning period for the loss, but then eventually you get the sense that he'll move on after the movie is over. He'll keep writing. And I think that's very true to life or any environment where you're trying to create something. We've all decided to be here for this moment, and we try to capture the moment and create something, but we can't hold on to it, and we can't go back to it. We can't go back to it and recreate it. It's just, it existed, and now it's gone, you know? And I think that idea is maybe what he was trying to get across.
So just winding down here, I want to ask you, is this character in Patterson, which of the characters that you've played, maybe it is this one in Patterson, do you feel is most similar to Adam Driver, the person? Is it somebody that, is this the guy that you feel most connected to or most similar to yourself?
I don't know. I think after, you know, there's elements of, you know, hopefully yourself and all the things that you get to do, even something like Star Wars, like that character makes sense to me in the family dynamic and desperately wanting family to be a part of his life, but not getting it. And, you know, the anxiety and a lot of anger that creates that lasts a lifetime. You know, when we finished that, I'm like, oh, that felt like we made it personal. Mm-hmm. But Patterson, and I relate to the structure that he has in his life, especially as a nomadic actor where you crave kind of a structure and where your life is maybe controlled. So in work, you can be less controlled. That makes sense to me. And just listening to people around you and not Patterson, similar to Jim, actually meets things without judgment and meets things that are new. He's open to the world around him. And his first impulse is curiosity, not to label it in anything.
Yeah.
Which I think is a beautiful thought. I don't know that there, you know, Silence in the Scorsese thing that we just did, he's a character that's full of doubt. And I relate to that a lot too, where.
We should say this is, if correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe you and Andrew Garfield, Jesuit priests.
Yes.
17th century.
17th century.
Going to find another Jesuit priest who's sort of gone off the grid a little bit.
Yes, that's 100%.
And right. With Scorsese.
With Scorsese, yeah, right. But that character is very much doubt. He's very, see St. Peter in my mind, he's completely committed to, and religion is like the boundaries, I guess, for the movie, but you can really insert any kind of, even acting or marriage, or where you've committed yourself to this thing, you're in it, you've designed your life around it, you know, I'm going to be an actor, this is what I'm going to do, and then it's not as simple as that's it, I've made the decision, now I just have to act it out. That's full of misery and doubt and second guessing and joy, you know, maybe. That kind of struggle is, I really relate to. So this is a long-winded way of saying there's not one thing, I guess, that I point to that's like, that's who I am.
And very last thing I've got to ask you is, you know, now for people who have either discovered you through perhaps a bigger thing like Star Wars or a smaller thing like Patterson or whatever it may be, they're probably anxious to know what's next. We've just established that one thing is Scorsese's Silence, which is coming out soon. Mm-hmm. And I believe you, just a massive demand for you to, I think you lost, did you lose 50 pounds for that movie?
Yeah, 51 pounds.
That's insane.
That last pound, I'm very proud of.
We're going to give you full credit. Yeah, yeah. So there's that. Obviously, I believe the Star Wars experience goes on, right? Uh-huh. When does that next one come out with you?
I don't know. Oh, I do know. I'm just, sorry. I don't know to any Star Wars. What is this movie? December of next year. Yeah.
And so, you know, apart from those two things, is there anything sort of that you're very anxious to do or accomplish or, you know, that's still on the bucket list for you?
I mean, there's lots of directors that I love to work. I just did this thing with Steven Soderbergh that I'm really, was really a blast because he's so... A blast. It was just really great because he's so economical with how he shoots things and takes out all of the noise on set. It working with him almost feels like a protest to kind of a traditional way of making movies, and it's really fun. The pace of it's so fast and it's very impulsive, and the actors that I got to work with on that, Channing Tatum, Daniel Craig, you know, Seth MacFarlane, all these like great people, Riley Keough. It was really, I had a good time on it. But apart from that, I have no plan other than to continue to hopefully work with really great directors if I'm lucky and I can do that. And it doesn't matter what medium or the budget or anything, you know, hopefully we'll pull Don Quixote together, but no plan.
All right. Well, it's a treat to watch you, and thank you so much for doing this.
Thanks
really
for having me. Yeah. Thanks. Nice seeing you.
Hey, Hey, Drew Scott here.
And I'm Jonathan Scott, reminding you that life's better with a home policy from American Family Insurance. They can help you get just the right protection at just the right price and help you save when you bundle home and auto. Kind of like Goldilocks and the Three Bears. It'll be just right for you. We love a custom build. American Family Insurance. Insure carefully. Dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.